Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from radiogrimbald.com. I am your host, Goldine Ogawa, and welcome to the fourth episode of Radio Grimbald. Fourth episode! I've been doing this for a month! I am so happy about that, even though when you consider how long some of the podcasts out there have been going, you know, you see the ones in with episode lists in the 200 and you sort of go... I mean, if you're me, you kind of go, and my brother totally just walked into the recording studio. I saw him outside and I'm like gesturing him to go away. I'm in the middle of recording. Can't you see that I'm talking into a microphone? And he sort of comes in like, what are you doing? And oops, well, that's family, but he is my brother and he is the reason that this podcast has such awesome theme music. So I really shouldn't try to alienate him. Hi, brother. You're awesome. Please don't kill me in my sleep. So this week, I'm going to be reading The Man in the Chest, which is a short story, a standalone short story. It's not really connected to any other story. It's kind of a long one. So I will not babble on this time. I shall just get straight to the story. This is The Man in the Chest, and I hope you enjoy it. The Man in the Chest. Copyright 2011 by Goldine Ogawa. This is a little story written for little girls. Do not be afraid of the dark.
There's a dead man in my room, Nat said.
If it had been anyone else, there would have been some cause for alarm. If, say, sensible Selina had made the same announcement, Mum and Dad Crafferty would have leapt to their feet, run up to investigate, rung up the police. General pandemonium would have ensued. But it was Nat. So Dad Crafferty took another sip of his cold coffee and Mum continued unpacking the wine glasses. Selina looked up from scrubbing gunk and black paste out from under the stove, her normally pretty face pale and strained. Moving house did not suit Selina at all.
"That's interesting, Nat, dear," she said. "Why don't you go up and finish unpacking?"
Nat blinked at her silently, then disappeared from the doorway in a whisper of bare feet on dusty floorboards. The reason the family showed no concern at her announcement was because Nat had a history of making up disturbing stories which sounded real enough, but always turned out to be nonsense. Like the time when she was 5 and she had insisted that she had seen Abni Kal, dark goddess of death, hiding in the attic of the neighbor's house. But when 3 priests and the local wizard went up to investigate, all they found was a large infestation of spiders, and not even poisonous ones at that. Then there was the incident when she was 8 and woke everyone up in the middle of the night, screaming that there was a portal open in her room, which apparently had only appeared once and would not open again. Selina, who was a junior apprentice mage at the time, declared that there was not even a weakening of dimensional walls that would indicate the presence of a portal, and everyone went back to bed very grumpy. And there had been the memorable time when, at the county fete, she had spent the whole day begging for a pony ride, but when Dad Crafferty had finally caved in and agreed, he found there were no ponies there at all. But Nat had said she'd seen one, black, with a smoky mane and tail that stood in the shadow of the chestnut tree and glowered at the crowds out of burning coal eyes. And so, when she had come down on the morning of their first day in the new house with the news of a dead man in her room, the family quite reasonably assumed that she was making up stories again. What the family did not know was that Nat had indeed seen Abni Kal, dark goddess of death, hiding in the attic of the neighbor's house. and there had been a portal open in her room, but whoever had opened it was a powerful adept, and had closed it so thoroughly afterward it left no trace. And there had been a smoking black horse under the chestnut tree. And so there was, also, a dead man in her room. At least, she was pretty sure he was dead. She had found him in the giant old chest that was bolted along one side of her bedroom. It had been locked, but after trying in vain for hours to cram all her belongings into the one bureau they had given her, Nat went on an extensive search of the room, which turned up, among other things, a great deal of lint and dead spiders, and a rusty iron key buried in an abandoned dust sprite nest under her bed. Being the curious and clever type, Nat tried the key, and, her delight, it fit and turned the old lock in the chest. She was filled with excitement as she raised the lid. Perhaps there was some great treasure inside, books, or old maps, maybe. Instead, there was him. He lay, wrapped in black silk and velvet, filling up the entire chest, which, judging by its size and shape, made him a very tall, thin man. His face was pale and a little bluish, with smooth, paper-like skin stretched over sculpted cheekbones and a prominent nose. His brows were heavy and cast dark blue shadows over the hollows of his eyes, which were shut. His raggedy mane of brown hair spread out in all directions like a shadowy halo. No breath passed his lips, which were even bluer than the rest of his skin, and his chest did not rise or fall. He was completely and utterly still. Even his expression was one of tranquility. Nat wondered for a moment if he was merely asleep, but when she touched his face he did not stir, and his skin was as cold as stone. Then she remembered the stories about princes and princesses that were enchanted to seem dead and await a kiss from a hero. Then she took another look at the man's strange blue skin and thought better of it. Instead, she went with the next best option, which was to poke him sharply in the chest and say, "Excuse me, sir, but you should wake up now." The man didn't stir. Half disappointed, half relieved, Nat had closed the lid and relocked it, putting the key in her trouser pocket, and had gone to tell the family. She called them the family because they were one, but they weren't really hers. She had been adopted and knew nothing about her real parents, and this was the strange part. No one else did either. She had turned up on the family's doorstep 6 years before, a 3-year-old in a black satin dress and muddy slippers, and the Quaffertys, after some waffling and whinging, took her in. At first, they treated her well enough, but as the years passed and Nat's eccentricities became apparent, a gap had formed, and this gap widened progressively over time to the point that the Quaffertys thought of Nat as an inconvenient burden on their lives. The one member of the family who was really like family at all was Brint, Selina's older brother. Brint was in his 20s and barely ever around. He worked at some famous ranch or other training flying horses, and only came to visit once or twice a year. But he did come and visit the very next day to help them move the furniture, and Nat seized the first chance she got to drag him up to her room and show him the man in the chest. "That's very nice, Nat," Brint said, when she had gotten him upstairs and proudly flung open the lid of the chest. He looked politely over the still, silent figure, rather as one politely shows interest in a friend's stamp collection. He turned to Nat, a confused expression on his open, fairish face. "There's nothing there, you know." Nat was dumbstruck. She looked from her big brother to the man in the chest. He looked as solid and real as ever. There were black smudges under his eyes that reminded her of Selina's makeup. "You really can't see him?"
"I'm afraid not," Brint said apologetically.
It was clear he thought she was just playing a game and was too tired to play along. Any other girl might have thrown a tantrum and insisted on proving the man was real. But Nat just sighed and closed the lid of the chest. It was too much work getting other people to believe what she saw. Still, once Brint had gone home and everyone else was asleep, Nat lay awake in her bed, doubt gnawing at the back of her mind. What if he wasn't really real? What if he was only a figment of her imagination? Sliding out of bed, she crossed her room to where the chest lay and lifted the lid. He lay there, still as ever, solid as ever, Nat discovered, when she poked his impressive nose with a testing finger. But she wasn't satisfied. She crossed her arms on the edge of the chest and rested her chin on them.
"You should prove to me you're real," she said sternly. "It's not nice, playing with a little girl's brain. I'll lock the chest and never open it again. Then you'll get all old and dusty and wither away like a forgotten apple."
Feeling she had expressed herself well enough, Nat went back to bed, leaving the chest lid open. The house was silent, and in the depths of that night, even after Nat had surrendered to sleep, something stirred. But even as the shreds of the ancient slumber that held it fast began to slip away, Nat rolled over in bed, wrestling out of the grasp of a bad dream, and everything was still again. He was there in the morning, as well as a thin layer of dust that had settled in the night. Nat pursed her lips in disappointment and shut the lid. True to her word, she locked it fast and stuck the key under her pillow before going down to breakfast. Ordinarily, she would have gone back up to her room after breakfast to fetch any items she might have forgotten, but there was a rush to get her to school, and she had to dash off after a hurried piece of toast. Ordinarily, she would have gone straight up to her room after getting home, but this time she brought a note from the teacher, and because of it, ended up with Mrs. Quafferty in lecture mode, and some stern words from Mr. Quafferty, too. Ordinarily, Nat was a very quiet girl, but that day, when she finally did make it up to her room, she had to have a good bawl into her pillow, because that was the only way to deal with one of Mrs. Crafferty's lectures. In any case, it wasn't until well into the evening, when she lay back on her bed, tear-stained cheek on her pillow, that she noticed the soft tap, tap, tapping that was coming, and had been coming since that morning, from inside the chest. Slowly, Nat sat up on her bed and swung her legs over the side. Slowly, she reached a hand under her pillow and felt her fingers close around the key. Slowly, she drew it out and stood up.
Tap. Tap. Tap, tap.
It was beginning to sound impatient, as if whatever was tapping knew she was just standing there. Nat went over to the chest and slid the key in the lock. As she turned it and heard the latch click, there was one last tap, and then silence. Nat drew a deep breath and lifted the lid. Brilliant, glowing, yellow eyes stared up at her out of a pale blue face. The blue lips were parted, and he was definitely breathing.
"So you are real, then?"
Nat asked reproachfully. Yellow eyes blinked, slowly, like a cat. The lips shut, then curved into a grin that looked decidedly evil.
"Do you really want to know the answer to that question?"
the man in the chest said. His voice was raspy with disuse. Nat frowned.
"Not really,"
she said, and began to close the lid. A long, white-blue hand rose up out of the blackness, caught the lid as it came down, and the man sat up, still smiling.
"Then you won't mind me getting up," he said,
and rose out of the chest as though he were as light as a feather. Nat took a step back, for he was very tall indeed, and the long hanging robes only made him look taller.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"That depends on who you are," the man said, his voice soft and deep and old, beyond reckoning.
"I'm Nat."
The man bent his thin neck to look down at her intently. His glowing eyes seemed to sparkle when he did that. Nat got the feeling that she had never been looked at like that before. It was as though this man could see who she was without being told. Or at least he was trying.
"No, no," he said, shaking his head. "That's not who you are at all. What's your name?"
Nat hesitated. She didn't like her real name. It was strange and unusual, and she only had it because it had been stitched to the inside of the dress she was wearing when the Craffertys found her. Still, when someone like this man asked you your name, you answered truthfully.
"My name is Nautica," Nat said, trying not to sound sullen.
"Closer, but not quite."
The man frowned and sucked in his cheeks, which only made the bones in his long blue face stand out more. Then he shrugged and waved a long blue hand.
"Still, it is the truth." "Then, Nautica, I am Marcus. Marcus Heathbone. But that's not who I am either."
"What is your name, then?" Nat asked.
She felt needled, and anyway, Marcus was a silly sort of name. Marcus bowed his head and looked grim. His eyes were narrow yellow slits, and his brows were knotting. He raised a hand before him, waving it back and forth as if he were trying to catch a drifting feather. Then he let it drop with a sigh of disappointment.
"I don't know anymore," he said.
He sounded grieved and a little wounded, as though his feelings had been hurt very badly. He looked so desolate, staring at his empty hand, with his robes drooping gloomily around him, that Nat felt a wave of sympathy surge over her.
"There, there," she said,
giving him a gentle pat on the sleeved elbow, which was as high as she could reach.
"I'm sure you'll remember it one day."
"It's not a question of remembering," Marcus said gloomily. "I simply don't know any more. They took it away, I guess. That must have been part of my punishment."
"Punishment?" Nat asked,
filled with curiosity. He pointed at the empty chest.
"That and this." He tapped his right temple. "I was supposed to sleep for eternity, I think. They must have taken some other things when they took my name. All my memories are rather fuzzy."
"Who are they?"
Marcus Heathbone's face went perfectly blank.
"That is not for you to ask, nor for me to tell," he said tightly.
Nat felt it was very much for her to ask, but now that Marcus had gone distant and boring, asking questions but not answering them, she decided she had had enough.
"Fine, then," she said. "Do what you like, but I'm going to bed."
So saying, she crossed the room and tucked herself in. Marcus stood in the center of the room, looking puzzled. Determined to ignore him, Nat firmly shut her eyes and pretended to go to sleep. Yet she remained awake for what felt like hours, listening as the strange man moved about her room, opened doors, shut them again, and then with a creak and a snap, shut himself back in his chest. He was still there the next morning, although this time when Nat opened the lid, he was wide awake and sprang out at once. In daylight, his skin was more paper white, and now his eyes were darker and did not glow.
"I've been thinking,"
he said, stretching his shoulders. Things are less fuzzy now.
Didn't you sleep?
Marcus stopped in mid-stretch, his arm lodged firmly behind his head.
No.
He took his arm down and looked at his palm, turned it over and then back again. Nat thought she caught a glimpse of a scar on his palm, white and raised like a burn mark. Then he closed his hand and withdrew it into his robe. Something seemed to bother him, and he glanced around the room as if he expected someone to be there, as if he was afraid of something.
Nautica,
he said, his soft voice breaking.
What year is it?
2375, Nautica said promptly. November, Thursday. The 18th, she added for good measure.
2375, Marcus repeated, incredulous. When he saw Nat nod, he sank onto her bed with a low groan.
47, he said, his face in his hands.
47 what? Nat asked.
Years. Years I was in that chest.
He rubbed a knuckle between his eyes, as if trying to rub the fact into his brain.
I thought it would be longer. I thought it would be centuries. If it had been centuries, I might have forgotten. But now...
Nat felt herself going mad with curiosity, but she could tell this was one of those dreadfully interesting subjects Marcus wouldn't tell her about. So she collected her clothes and headed for the bathroom. When she got out, Marcus was waiting for her on the stairs, fidgeting with a gold talisman on a chain. It was a metal arrow with wide, curved prongs, pointed down.
"Where are you going?"
he asked as she stalked past.
"To breakfast," Nat replied.
"And then?"
"School, of course."
"Does that mean leaving the house?"
Something about the way Marcus spoke made Nat pause on the stairs. He was looking down at her with the same inhuman intentness as before, only now it was laced with concern and not a little bit of fear. Something inside Nat quailed at the thought of what would make a person like Marcus afraid.
"Yes," she said.
Marcus seemed ready to forbid her leaving, but Mum Crafferty began yelling that Nat would be late again if she didn't come down. Now! So hurry up! Nat obediently turned to go the rest of the way down, but Marcus came after and grabbed her by the elbow. It was, Nat realized, the first time he had ever touched her, at least while he was awake. He wasn't cold anymore. Nat could feel him right through her sleeve, like the tingling one gets when one's arm is about to fall asleep. It made Nat freeze on the spot, but then Marcus had to let go to drop the strange talisman into her hand.
"That should help. Or maybe it will only draw them to you. I'm not sure."
He seemed deeply unhappy.
"It needs my name to work properly, and I don't have that."
"Yeah, what good is it?"
"Protection, mostly. You may sense danger if it is near."
"And if I do?"
"Run," Marcus said, smiling. "Run, if you can. Goodbye, and good luck."
He stepped backwards up the stairs and disappeared into the shadows. Nat went down to breakfast with mixed feelings. There was a dog on the street when Nat went out to catch the bus. She was in a hurry, so she didn't notice much about it other than the fact that it was a ragged, sorry creature, something that at one time might have been a magnificent animal, but was now reduced to a skeletal wraith with matted fur and wide staring eyes. It watched Nat forlornly as she pelted down the street and made a flying leap to catch the bus as it pulled away. Then it went up to the doorstep, sniffed at the threshold, and, catching a scent, followed Nat's trail to where she had got onto the bus. There it picked up its head and bounded off after the vehicle faster than any ordinary dog could. So when Nat got off the bus, there was a dog outside the school gate, but she had other things on her mind then and didn't notice it at all. When one is a reserved, eccentric girl who looks and listens but doesn't speak much, it is only to be expected that you are the first on the list for those looking for someone to pick on. Such was Nat's lot, and so, when she bumped into the wrong body as she stepped off the bus, it turned around and boxed her on the ears. She tripped and stumbled into the gutter, dirty water splashing over her back and down her socks. She picked herself up slowly, waiting for the jeering crowd to disperse. Only they didn't. Instead, they pressed in closer, the jeers turning to hisses as hands with claw-like nails pawed at her. Nat recoiled, staring back in horror as the crowd had turned into ragged fiends, pale and flame-like, with burning red eyes. A sound tore through the air, something between a roar and a snarl, and she was ringed around by sneering adolescents once again.
"Clafferty's clack today,"
someone sniggered amidst the tramp of feet as the crowd moved on. Nat hoisted herself shakily to sit on the curb, then looked up to find herself nose to nose with the staring gaunt dog. It sniffed at her experimentally, perking its ears as it caught a familiar scent. "You have Master's pendant," it said in a soft, mild voice. Unthinkingly, Nat reached up and clasped the strange upside-down cross hanging from her neck.
"Are you no Marcus?" she asked.
The dog's bony face bunched in a frown.
"That's not Master's name, but I know of whom you speak. Why has he not returned to his realm to reclaim his throne?
Do you hold him prisoner?"
"I don't... No, no, of course not!"
Nat exclaimed as the dog's tone grew more menacing.
"He's at my home right now. I just let him out of the chest last night. I don't think he's very well. He couldn't remember his name."
The dog's expression grew, if possible, even grimmer.
"That is grave news indeed. I would advise you to keep away, only I see he has already seen fit to give you his pendant."
"What does that mean?"
Nat asked. It was unsettling to see it talk, for as it spoke its features seemed to grow more human. But as soon as it ceased to talk, it looked like an ordinary dog again, save for a deep twinkle of intelligence in its eyes.
"It means you are under my protection, such as it is," the dog said. "But I will not always be near, and the keeper is drawing close. Remember, the pendant will burn her. Also, if you were able to free Master, then you must have no small power yourself. Farewell."
The dog paused, one tufty eyebrow bunching up.
"What is your name?"
"Natika,"
Nat said, having learned her lesson from the night before.
"Only please call me Nat."
"As you wish," the dog said diffidently.
"Farewell, Nat.
I am Bryfang. You would do well to remember that name."
Nat watched Bryfang trot away down the sidewalk, an ordinary starving stray, but now with a bounce in his gait and a gleam to his coat that had not been there before. Nat got up from the curb and made her way inside the school, whose bell had rung minutes before. For once, the prospect of being late didn't strike her as very important at all. It struck Mrs. Lynch as terribly important, and Nat was forced to lag behind the rest of the class for a severe tongue-lashing. Nat had more important things on her mind and didn't pay much attention. Mrs. Lynch persisted and ended with having her step up to the blackboard to write out, "I will not dawdle or be late," 50 times. Nat's fingers had barely closed around the chalk when she felt a blast of hot air on the back of her neck, and a smell like burning rubber filled the room. Mrs. Lynch was no longer there. In her place was a ghastly presence made of fire and smoke and swirling ash. Eyes, one that blazed like a sun, the other dark as a bottomless pit, focused on Nat, and the mouth that opened looked like a gateway to hell. Perhaps it was.
"Where are you hiding him, mortal?"
The voice was jarring and rang in her ears. It never occurred to Nat to ask who she was hiding. She knew what the voice meant, and it knew that. Fortunately, it had asked the wrong question.
I'm not hiding anyone,"
she said, her voice breaking and thin beside the deep roar from the mouth of hell. The fire decreased, but the ash intensified and reached out in tendrils as if to pull Nat in.
"Then tell us where he is. Tell us where we can find him."
It was not a question. It was a command. There was no way for Nat to resist. It was like being sucked into a tunnel by some inexorable force. But despite all that, she kept her presence of mind and her memory. The thing was poking around the fringes of her mind, bringing memories of Marcus forward in her head. With the memories came words. "My name is Marcus Heathbone, but that is not who I am." And she realized she had a way to cheat the thing.
"I don't know who you're talking about,"
she screamed, coughing on the ash. It burned.
"I don't know who you're asking for."
The ash retreated. The fire died. The glowing eye sank to a malignant red. Then, with a snap, the presence disappeared. Mrs. Lynch folded her arms and cleared her throat.
"I want those lines written out before lunch, Nat," she snapped and closed the door behind her.
The lines were crooked and the letters hopelessly garbled. Nat's hand was shaking so bad. Still, she cranked them out at last. Out in the hall, things were worse. It was crowded and noisy, and every stray elbow or sudden bump made Nat whirl and stare, expecting to find something terrible coming after her. There was a commotion down the hall. People were exclaiming and pointing. Some of them were jeering, but most of them shrank back against the wall in silent awe. Marcus was coming up the hall towards her. He towered over the other students, looking horribly and terrifyingly out of place among the sneakers and jeans and backpacks in his flowing shroud-like robes. These swirled and billowed behind him, and stars twinkled in the shadowy folds of the cloth. Staring down the hall at him, the students parting like waves of a sea, Nat thought she saw the ordinary world, the world most people lived in, torn aside. Where Marcus walked, it was dark and mysterious, with things and ideas that had no place in a public school. He walked right up to her and stopped, as if she were the only person in the whole place.
"It isn't safe here. You must leave."
Nat was about to wholly agree when a harsh voice barked at her from down the hall.
"Clafferty, the principal wants you, now!"
The voice was followed by an older student, one who had begun to shave already. He marched down the hall, right past Marcus without a second glance, and grabbed Nat by the elbow. Hopelessly, she found herself dragged to that dreaded office. Marcus followed, looking annoyed. Principal Horwood was a round man with three jutting chins and cheeks puffed and red from frequent shouting. These puffed out farther in anticipation of more shouting as Nat entered the office, Marcus sliding in behind her, quiet as air. As she took a seat in front of the desk, Principal Horwood shuffled his papers importantly and squinted down at Nat, his jowls chomping together as though warming themselves. He didn't see Marcus at all.
"Miss Quafferty, your behavior of late has been disappointing."
His mouth chomped, the cheeks quivered.
"I'm very sorry, sir," Nat said, hoping docility would be the fastest way out.
"Apologies won't help here," Principal Horwood said. "Your behavior has been very disappointing."
He picked up one of the many sheets and slapped it with a meaty hand.
"Absent-mindedness, inability to socialize, lost homework. This is appalling."
"I do not see the relevance this has to our situation," Marcus said.
Principal Horwood didn't hear. He tossed the sheet aside and moved on.
"You do not join in with the other children when they play. You never participate in class projects. You are always late."
He was beginning to come into his stride. Nat could tell they would be here for a while.
"This is trivial and pointless," Marcus said, giving up on the principal and turning to Nat. "Nautica, we must leave, and leave now. They are coming. They may already be here."
"Yes, I know, Nat said. She could feel them, whoever they were, like a big hot sore on her brain.
"Don't interrupt me, Miss Quafferty,"
Principal Horwood shouted, his anger underlined by a thin current of glee. Marcus coughed. Principal Horwood choked on his next sentence. For the first time, he saw the strange pale man standing behind Nat's chair. Marcus's eyes glowed fiercely yellow, and there was a tangible air of darkness around him. And when he spoke, the voice filled the room, shook the windows, and reverberated off the walls.
"We do not have time for this. You are endangering everyone by keeping the girl here. We are leaving. Now."
Marcus took Nat by the elbow and helped her up. Principal Horwood was a strange shade of purple now, gasping and writhing in his chair. As they reached the door, he gave a strangled cry and slumped forward on his desk. A moment later, the room began to fill with an acrid smell that made Nat's eyes water. Marcus's grip on her arm tightened.
"They found us."
The office door slammed behind them as they tore out into the hall, but it couldn't block the strange, hissing, screaming that rang in Nat's ears. There were words in the screaming, too.
"You are a fool to run. You cannot escape us."
The door to the principal's office was blown off its hinges as something leapt out into the hall behind them. Marcus didn't look. Nat did. It was Principal Horwood, bent over and drooling, with flame leaping from his eyes.
"Time to leave," Marcus said.
And then they left. It was like being in a whirlwind of shadows and flying ash. Visions chased each other in circles, with Nat and Marcus at the center. With stinging eyes and ringing ears, Nat tumbled forward into the dark, only to land with a thump on the rough gravel and dirt of an empty lot. It was a heavy, overcast day, yet strangely dry. There was no chance of rain.
"The clouds gather," Marcus said from above her.
He was looking at the sky, yet his whole body drooped.
"The hordes are coming."
"The hordes of what?"
Nat gasped, still a little shaken from their sudden journey.
"Who's after you?"
A skeletal wind chased a dead leaf across the barren ground. Marcus sighed.
"You're a curious girl, Nautica."
He touched the pendant still hanging from her neck.
"Don't you know what that means?"
Nautica, whose parents were as likely to attend church as a brick is to sing, shook her head.
"Hell."
But she was not ignorant.
"I thought hell was a place," she said.
"It is also a person," Marcus said. "She is called the Keeper, and she is very terrible."
There was a distant roaring sound, growing louder and not so distant by the minute.
"They come," he said. "You would do well to run."
"No," Nat said, picking herself up off the dirt. Marcus looked down at her, smiling sadly.
"When I was who I used to be," he remarked, "I protected people like you. Now there is nothing left, not even for myself. Have no delusions, Nautica. I cannot save you, nor myself."
Nat frowned, confused, but just then they were caught up in another whirlwind, only this one was made of fire. It tore at them like an angry beast, and the scalding winds buffeted on all sides. When it subsided, they were still in the vacant lot, only now it was full of people. "People" was a loose term. Nat thought she saw a goat with a snake's head and a giant wasp. There was a woman with 8 legs, not arms, and a man with lobster claws, and there were others which she was glad she didn't recognize. There were hundreds, perhaps thousands of them, stretching away into the distance, yet they all seemed to fit into that acre of barren ground. Although Nat couldn't see all of them, for a reddish haze spread about their feet, she could feel every single one. And they did not feel pleasant. It hurt her head. Then the haze parted. Through it, 2 figures walked, or one of them walked, the other slithered. The one that slithered was half snake and half man with octopus tentacles for arms. 3 of these were wound around a pole, flying a standard made of something that fluttered and flapped like flayed skin tacked over bone. The one that walked was a woman. Impossibly tall, hideous, and beautiful, her hair crackling like burning leaves. 1 eye was a blazing inferno, the other a window into emptiness. Nat felt her knees begin to shake.
"Exile, come forward!"
It was the woman who spoke, only there was no voice. It was a cacophony of agonized screaming that formed itself into words inside her head. Marcus, shoulders slumped, walked forward 2 paces. He was inches away from the woman.
"Greetings, Hell," he said.
"The seal set on you was broken. You must return to your prison. Surrender your key."
There was a horrible silence. Fire hissed and the horde ground its collective teeth.
"I cannot,"
Marcus said, his voice cracked and feeble.
"What do you mean?"
the man snake octopus said.
"He has given it away," Hell said. "His savior has his key. His savior will now share his fate."
"No!"
It took a lot out of Marcus, Nat could tell. He was hunched over now, almost on his knees. She wanted to help him, save him, somehow. But her legs wouldn't stop shaking, and she was beginning to feel ill.
"You are in no position to refuse us,"
the snake man octopus snapped. Thrusting his standard aside, he surged forward and grabbed Nat by her wrist. It burned like ice and fire and acid at the same time. Nat was blinded by it. It seemed the whole world had become a single bright fireball and she was burning up in it. Then several things happened at once. The pendant hanging from her neck shot a beam of energy into the snake man octopus. Marcus shouted, screamed. It sounded like his voice was breaking. Nat fell forward on her face. For a while she lay, winded, feeling the searing pain in her wrist begin to subside. Slowly she lifted her aching head and looked up. She was utterly alone. The frail wind rustled the weeds in the vacant and completely empty lot. Nat sat up. She still felt ill, but the sensation was ebbing. Looking down at her wrist, she saw there was now an ugly black burn mark where the snake man octopus had grabbed her. It smelled bad, and when she touched it, the pain redoubled. Gritting her teeth, she got to her feet. Marcus was gone. The hordes were gone. Hell was gone. There was nothing, not even a wisp of a presence to be felt. Nat hobbled away unsteadily. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do. Find Marcus? Run away? Go home? For the moment, she settled on finding a quiet, peaceful place to sit down, like a park of some sort. She recognized this part of the city now, and she knew there was a park nearby. So she set off. But the pain in her wrist was returning. It got into her head and made her dizzy. Struggling forward, half unsure where she was going, she nearly leapt out of her skin when a giant dog appeared out of nowhere, walking beside her.
"Raifang?" she asked, hopefully.
"Yes," the dog said. It was a big, shaggy dog with halfway perked ears and soft, tawny fur.
"Marcus is gone. They took him. I couldn't stop them. I hurt now. I think I need to lie down."
"Stop," Braifang said. Nat stopped.
"Sit."
Nat collapsed into a heap on the sidewalk.
"Where are you hurt?"
Nat gingerly extended her wrist. Braifang's tufty brows bunched over his eyes.
"Did the gomel touch you?"
"I'm not sure," Nat said. "It was a snake man, only he had octopus tentacles, and he carried this horrid—"
"It was the gomel, I thought so. Has his stench about it."
Braifang wrinkled his nose in distaste, then gently began to lick the burn. Nat hissed. It stung at first, but slowly the burning pain was washed away, and her head cleared.
"Better?"
"Yes, I think it'll be all right." Nat looked up. Suddenly, the full force of recent events caught up with her.
"They took Marcus!"
"Yes, they did," Braifang said grimly.
"And what are they going to do to him?"
Braifang looked at his paws.
"Put him back in prison. But they will probably start by taking his eyes out, and then his tongue. Hell has a nice collection of tongues. She took mine once."
"We have to stop them," Nat cut in, not wanting to hear any more. Braifang perked an ear, so it stood perfectly erect.
"You wish to help, Master?"
"Well, yes," Nat said. "No one deserves to have their eyes taken out, or their tongue." The dog was looking at her alertly, a shine in his eyes that had not been there before.
"There is one thing we, or should I say you, can do. The one thing that can save Master."
"And what is it, then?" Braifang looked her straight in the eye.
"You must find his name."
Nat followed Braifang through the city. They went by backways and alleys, through culverts and under hedges. She kept having temporary bouts of dizziness, and her wrist was sore and tender, though that was still an improvement. Marcus's pendant clinked reassuringly against her chest. Braifang had said it would be important in finding his name. The way he was leading her, Nat suspected he already knew where it was. They were heading towards the city center, through downtown to where most of the corporate high-rise buildings were. Braifang threaded his way in and out and in between the busy streets, walking slowly but steadily and never wavering. Their destination turned out to be the service door of a large hotel. It faced a grungy, deserted parking lot, and when Nat tried the handle, it was locked. Undaunted, Braifang got up on his hind legs and pulled the lever with his paws. The door swung open. Peering inside, Nat saw it was dark and empty. The walls were whitewashed and cracked, with bare piping running along the ceiling.
"You'll find his name in there," Breifeng said. "It will be the first writing you see."
"You're not coming?" Nat asked. There was no answer. Looking around, she found herself completely alone.
"I guess not,"
she said to herself, and squared her shoulders as she marched through the door. Inside, it was dark and dirty and smelled of dead air. She walked slowly, scanning the walls, the floor, and the ceiling for any kind of writing. Then she spied it, a large white sign bolted to the wall. Heart quickening, she broke into a trot. The sign said, "Security meeting, first Tuesday of every month. Bring your own donuts." Nat stared. She closed her eyes, rubbed them, and stared again. It was the same. Undaunted, Nat continued to look. She looked at it upside down and sideways, through squinted eyes, and even tried reading it backwards. But that only gave her nonsensical gibberish. More than that, she never felt like it sounded right. The way Marcus and Breifeng talked of names, Nat got the feeling they were more than a word for a person. To ordinary people, names were simply labels to distinguish one person from another. For people like Marcus, it was them, in their entirety, in a word. Marcus's name was as much a part of him as his hands or his hair or his heart, assuming people like Marcus had hearts. Therefore, Nat reasoned, Marcus's name would be like a piece of himself, or all of himself, and not just an ordinary word written in the ordinary way. And there was the thing. If Marcus's name was like himself, not just anybody would be able to read it, let alone see it, the way Marcus was invisible to Brint or Principal Horwood. But Nat had been able to see him, so why couldn't she see his name? Because it had to be there, somewhere. Breifeng had said... Breifeng. Thinking of Breifeng, Nat remembered the dog as she had first seen him. Gaunt and bony, with that strange touch of humanity about his face as he spoke. Then as she had last seen him, a giant, shaggy, and ordinary dog. Ordinary. Nat looked at the sign again. Ordinary. She thought of the vacant lot. Ordinary. Everything had been ordinary since Marcus disappeared. Since the Gommel had touched her. Absently, Nat fingered the burn on her wrist. Since Breifeng had licked it, she had felt little pain, but there was still a feeling in her gut that something was wrong, and now she knew what it was. She couldn't sense things anymore. For as long as Nat could remember, she could sense things other people couldn't. Spirits, ghosts, gods, and Marcus... She could feel their energy and understand them when other people couldn't even hear them. But now all that was gone. Gone since the Gommel had touched her. She had thought the vacant lot was empty, but it must have been teeming with demons. She just hadn't been able to see them anymore. Marcus had probably been right there, and she hadn't even noticed. No wonder she couldn't find his name. It was a horrible sensation, like realizing you have lost a hand or an arm. Frustrated, Nat pushed out with the part of her mind that felt the spiritual side of things, and ran up against a solid wall. The wall was cold, yet it burned, and Nat knew the Gomo must have put it there. When he had touched her, he had taken her strange power, the one thing that could save Marcus, and sealed it away. And Nat was angry. For the first time, she was really angry. She clawed at the wall in her mind, kicked it, tore at it with bleeding hands, but it was impenetrable. Then she remembered the pendant. Marcus's pendant. It had attacked the Gomo before. Nat grasped it in both hands, the upside-down cross with bent-back arms, like an arrow. An arrow that pierces and tears flaming and bright. The arrow flew, striking the solid wall of the Gomel's seal. For a second the wall held. Then it shattered, tumbling down on itself and scattering into dust. Nat came back to herself to find she had squeezed her eyes shut, and there was a terrible burning sensation in her palms. Not the strange cold hot burn of the Gomel seal, but the searing pain of holding a red-hot metal object. With a cry, Nat let go of Marcus's pendant and opened her eyes. It was as though a veil had been lifted in her mind. Where before there had only been the dingy corridor and dusty corners, now she could feel spirits crawling and skittering in the darkness. On her wrist were the frayed remnants of the Gomel seal, slowly disintegrating, and before her on the plain white sign, shining in letters of pale blue light, was Marcus's name. Nat knew it was his name. It was not even so unlike Marcus, and carried a weight and power that was unmistakable. It was Marcus Heathbone, and everything he was and all the power that went with him. And the history, Nat thought uncomfortably, squinting at the name. Now she read it again. She found it was a familiar name, for she had read it in legends and myths many times before. He was a guardian demon, one of the fallen angels, the saint of dark magicians and a knight of hell. It gave Nat pause to think what kind of force had sundered his power and put him in the chest, and what he would do once he had it back again. Even in the kindest legends, he had always been a sinister character. But then she remembered him bowed before hell, insisting she be left alone. She remembered him giving her his pendant, and the last she had seen, him screaming as the Gomel sealed her power. His concern, his regret, his fear.
"When I was who I was, I protected people like you."
He had said that to her. Whatever else he was on her side. Nat walked back down the passage, a new spring in her step, and the warmth of Marcus's name glowing inside her. Bryfang was waiting for her in the parking lot. Not the big, shaggy, ordinary Bryfang, but the same gaunt dog she had first seen. Skin and flaking fur hung loosely on his thin, bony frame, and there was a spark in his eyes that spoke of power beyond his looks. His ears perked hopefully when he saw Nat. She grinned. "I have it! Where to now?" Bryfang smiled in a way that was all too human.
"Now we go to hell. Put your hand on my side. It'll be easier that way."
Nat placed her right hand firmly over the dog's shoulders, and together they walked. To Nat, it seemed they did not walk very far, certainly no more than 10 paces. But with each pace, they traveled a great distance. Thump went her foot for the first time, and instead of hitting pavement, it came down in soft sand. They were in a desert with a streaked red sky overhead. Thump for the second time, and now she nearly lost her shoe in a quagmire. Bryfang walked on, seeming to float over the mud. Thump again, and they were walking down an echoing black marble corridor. Pale white spirits drifted by the ceiling, but Nat only caught a glimpse before, thump, drifting mist and a smell of jasmine. Thump, a narrow strip of rock over bubbling magma. Thump, Nat nearly slipped on deep frozen ice. Splash! This time her foot came down in a shallow stream. The next step had no thump at all because they were falling through a smoky atmosphere lit from below with a dull reddish glow. Calmly, Bryfang walked on. Thump! Dry dirt with pale golden grass stretching away into the distance. Thump! They had arrived in a vaulted rock cave, its far walls lost in murky black smoke. They stood on a floating circle of polished stone above a river of magma far below. Nat felt its presence as a vague heat burning on the soles of her feet, but this sensation was lost on her for the overwhelming presence that stood on the other side of the circle. Hel was there, her shining eye positively blinding, while her dark eyes seemed to suck the energy out of everything nearby.
Bryfing, your pitiful resistance is not acceptable. You will be punished.
Bryfang cowered, tail between his legs. Nat felt her breath catch in her throat. It was like being bathed in scalding water. Her knees were shaking and she felt ready to puke. It was worse, if possible, than in the vacant lot. This was Hell's home ground. They were in Hell. Then Hell turned to look at her and she thought she would faint. It was like having her mind pressed between two hot rocks. Dark clots were appearing before her eyes.
What do you hope to achieve here, mortal? You are in my domain now.
She is only human. Leave her alone,
Bryfang growled through his teeth.
Humans are my property, Bryfang. Those that descend are my right, as was ordained in the beginning.
She leaned forward, seeming to grow larger and nearer so that her voice burned Nat's face.
You fall under me.
And she reached out a hand, pure and gnarled, shining yet dark.
Come.
Nat's legs moved of their own accord, and her mind was nearly lost in the whirling darkness. Yet the motion jolted her back to what remained of her senses. Marcus's pendant bumped against her chest, and she realized Hell was wrong. She didn't belong to Hell, she belonged to him. Coughing and weak, she spat out his name. Hell paused, partially retracting her hand. She seemed unsure.
Ma-sha-val,
Nat said, clearer this time. She raised her face to look at Hell, and that was a mistake. It was all horrible clashes of pearly smooth skin and oozing pustules. The left side seemed to be melting, and there were teeth in places they shouldn't be. Her nose was like an ivory hook. Nat felt her knees giving out, and she knew she would not be able to breathe for very much longer, let alone speak.
I call Mashaval!
She was falling, collapsing, but she never hit the stone, never felt the jarring stop. Instead, strong hands seized her under the arms and held her steady. Gentle darkness fell on her burning mind, shielding her from the gaze of Hell. Marcus stood over her, Bryfang looming larger and fiercer than ever by his side. But he was no longer Marcus. No longer the strange man in the chest, and no longer a broken fragment. He was whole again. He was Mashaval. His eyes blazed golden, and shadowy wings sprung from his shoulders. Horns burst from his head, curving into wicked blades, and his skin glowed white, an opalescent radiance that shone brighter and gentler than Hell's eye. Hell, Nat remembered, had been made by the devil to host the souls of the damned, but Mashaval had been an angel once, and righteous defense was not unknown to him. Hell recoiled, making sounds Nat was glad she didn't hear properly.
That is my property, you hold. Hand her over.
Mashaval smiled, a smile of someone who is untouchable and knows it.
Her soul is mine, Hell, he said calmly. You have no claim on her.
It is my right.
It is also mine.
Mashaval raised his right hand, palm up.
Hell, I have been called. My imprisonment is broken. My exile is over.
Hell screamed. It was a scream that shook her realm from the foundations up and reverberated throughout the underworld. But Nat Raifeng and Marcheval didn't hear it. They were standing in the parking lot behind the large hotel. Nat felt her mind pick bits of itself off the ground and begin to put itself back together. Vaguely, she noticed Marcheval touching her shoulder. He still had horns, which Nat found a little disturbing. One was placed right in the middle of his forehead, and it was nearly 5 inches long. It looked wicked sharp.
Nautica. Nautica, can you hear me?
What?
Nat shook her head, trying to clear it.
Thank you, Nautica.
Nat looked at him thickly, partly because her head still hurt a little, and partly because she wondered, now she knew who he really was, if he seemed any different. He didn't, apart from the horns. He was fuller, somehow, and complete. And he may have been a guardian demon, a fallen angel, the saint of dark magicians, and a knight of hell, but he was still, in a way, Marcus Heathbone. His face still held that concerned look, and he was still looking out for her. But that was who he was. He took her hand and led her gently out of the parking lot.
Come, he said. I will take you home.
They walked back to Nat's house together, the three of them. When Mum Quafferty got the door, still harried after numerous calls from the school, she saw a tall, pale gentleman in a dark suit holding Nat by the hand.
"Good evening, madam," the tall gentleman said. "I believe you were missing this," he indicated Nat.
Mum Quafferty expressed her delighted surprise and welcomed Nat inside, thanking the gentleman profusely. The gentleman smiled and said it was his pleasure, and wished her a very fine evening. But before she could close the door, Nat pushed her head back out and called after him. "Will I ever see you again?" The gentleman laughed.
"If you wish to, of course. It's my job to look after people like you. Just call my name."
At any other time, Mum Quafferty would have demanded to know the meaning of this, but at the moment it struck her as perfectly reasonable. It certainly made Nat very happy, and she bounded upstairs, cheerfully refusing to answer any questions about where she had been that afternoon. The end. Author's note. The demons that Nat meets on her adventures with Marcheval are all part of a pantheon of supernatural entities that are connected to a religion called etherealism, though not all of them are happy to admit this. Hell is both a being and a place, and is more or less in charge of the middle order of demons, such as Marcheval. She is not a very nice person, unsurprisingly, and often devises arbitrary and rather nasty punishments for her subjects as a way to amuse herself. Many years prior to locking Marcheval in a chest and hiding his name, she had a hand in sealing his twin brother, Raphael, saint of thieves and traitors, into an amulet that caused a great deal of trouble in the mortal world. How Raphael made his own escape is told in Goldine O'Gower's graphic novel series, Angel Devil, which can be read online at angeldevilmanga.com. And that is The Man in the Chest. I remember writing it. I began it and thought it was going to be a novel. And I got about to the middle of it and was sort of having trouble with it and then realized it was actually a short story and I could just put the end right there and make it a short story and everything worked out just fine. That's what I remember from writing it. But no, it was a lot of fun. And I kept imagining that Nat and Marcheval would crop up again. But they haven't yet. Yet being the operative word, of course. This story, like all of my stories, is available as an ebook. Man in the Chest is available as a standalone short story for just $1. If you are a Nook Barnes & Noble Nook Reader, you can get it on Barnes & Noble. If you have a Kindle, you can get it on Amazon in the US, UK, France, or Germany Kindle stores. If you have an iPad or an iPhone, or you do your ebooks through iTunes, you can get it if you are in the US, UK, France, Germany, Canada, or Australia. And I hope that you do, because every time you buy an ebook, you are helping with the podcast. So, if you like the stories, please head on over to goldeenogawa.com and click on the books tab, and you can find out, you can find nice little handy links for where to buy all of my ebooks. Now, next week, I'll be back to reading from Fiddler's Dream and other stories. I'll be reading the final story in that collection. I'm going to be reading The Piper in the Dell. And I hope you tune in next week for that. If you have any thoughts, comments, or questions for the podcast, I'd love to hear them. You can send them to me by sending me an email at goldeenogawa, that's goldeenogawa, at gmail.com. And that about wraps up show number 4. Before you go, I have to remind you that special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimball go out to Marion Goldeen, my wonderful mother, Evan Ogawa, and Rachel Goldeen for creating the theme music, and of course to you for listening. Radio Grimball is written, performed, edited, and just about everything else by me, Goldeen Ogawa. Find out more on the web at radiogrimbald.com and goldeenogawa.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, take care and have fun.